All right, if y'all could grab those doors in the back, and we'll jump into this. Obviously, in just an hour's time, we're not going to deal with all issues about parenting of all things. That's not going to be able to pull that off. But to give a baseline or some basic concepts for engaging with parenting and those questions and conversations, it's kind of one of those funny things. Like, I guess probably most churches don't know what their pastor's perspective on parenting necessarily is. And so you'll get that as well as, which just may be interesting to you for whatever weird reason. But on top of that, this is the way we train at parenting seminars and conferences through Aletheia. When we go and speak on parenting issues or whatever, this is the fundamental. So this is the first, if we were to do a 4 hours or 5 hours of parenting training, this is our number one. And so it's the base philosophy of what we believe, and it's what I developed a long time ago in regards to this. And it really comes down to this principle, this biblical principle, that parenting is fundamentally about modeling the kingdom of God and representing God well to your children. It's really not much more complicated than that conceptually. Now, that's the job of all disciples at all times, is to model the kingdom and to represent Christ well. And that's what it means to be a disciple of Christ. That's what you do at work. That's what you do in your marriage. It's what you do at church. It's what you do in whatever situation, right? That's really fundamentally, we're his ambassadors. We're the examples of that. So we want to model that. Now, what's strange to me is how often, like we talk about with marriage, that we don't apply that teaching in our marriage, and how often in parenting we don't apply that teaching in our parenting. We think that parenting is somehow a totally independent path of behavior or philosophy than being a disciple and follower of Jesus Christ. It isn't. It's really fundamentally the same thing. The long-term goal, in my opinion, the success of a parent is measured by how far a child has to turn their neck when they realize you're not God. And then they have to find the real one. How far do they have to turn? The less they have to turn in order to find the real character of the real God is an indication of how well you modeled this. And so some of you grew up in really nightmarish families, really bad places under bad conditions and in bad situations with abusive or angry or impatient or whatever. All of us grew up with imperfect families, dysfunctional families to some degree or more or less. But the more those were off base, the further you had to at some point turn between going, oh, that's not the father, that's just my father. And how far did you have to turn to recognize, oh, that's the father? In any type of counseling, especially trauma-based counseling, we always end up having to engage with people in regards to what is their view of God. And so often their view of God, your view of God intuitively is largely dad. Now, it may also be a combination of mom and dad together, but largely it's going to be intuitive. Now, you may have learned at some point, That's not God. That's just my father. That's not the father. You may have made that leap. You may have made that turn. But it's still going to always have that kind of intuitive feel. Your orthopraxy, the way you live out your Christian life, is going to be tinged by that. So if you have an unavailable dad or a dad who you know he loves you and he's out there somewhere, I just don't see him very often, it's going to be natural for you to think of God that way. Well, I know he loves me and he's out there. I just don't see him very often. Or if dad or mom was however they parented. And so it's natural for us to do that. Again, part of the adult conversion and sanctification is the process of realizing they're just a father. They are just parents. They are not the parent. So the degree to which we exemplify the maternal and paternal traits of God, that is the determination of how good a parent we are. And so we just have a very close relationship with children to get to do that. Now, one of the things that's important is to recognize God has a very specific set of traits that he wants us to grow up into. They're scattered all throughout the New Testament. of different things he wants us to grow up into. If you don't, Ephesians 4 is a great place to look. Philippians chapter 2 is a great place to look. In fact, the whole book of Colossians and Ephesians and Philippians are great places to look about what it looks like to grow up in Christ, what it means to grow up in these things. So he has a list of traits, and you can count on the fact that what God is allowing or placing or engaging with in your life is training you towards some of those things. That's part of why they're there. In the same way, we need to have a mindset for what are some of the things we want our children to have at some point in life. That when you say, and we won't take the time to do it, but if you've never done this, if you never sat down with your spouse, or if you never sat down by yourself, if you don't have a spouse who can have this conversation, and ask yourself, what are the skill sets and mindsets that we want our children to have when they leave our home? What are the rules? What are the guidelines? What are the ways they engage with the world? What do we want those to be when they leave our home someday? And here's the problem. If you can't define that, then apparently your parenting is going to be just kind of all over the map. Because if you don't have something that you're working toward, listen, how do I decide whether to parent my child this way or this way? How to engage in this condition or that condition? Well, if you don't know where you're going, then if you don't know your destination, then your direction is going to always be confused. So if you say, I want my children to have this or that, and we talked about that last week, and we talked about how one of the most powerful tools for that, no matter what it is, if you say, I want my child to be respectful, well, then that's when I said, wouldn't it be cool if God gave you a relationship in your life that would allow you to model respect for your children day in and day out, when you're at your best and when you're at your worst? And fortunately, God has given you a relationship like that. It's called marriage. And that you're supposed to do that. That's part of the model. That's why having a great marriage is maybe the first primary step of being a great parent in some way. So, but when you think about that, then you ask yourself, if you evaluate the way we parent, is it moving our children towards these traits? Is it moving our children towards the traits that we want them to have, towards the skill sets and mindsets, or is it not? Is it just random and reactive? Well, is random and reactive a skill set you want for your children? If it is, then you're probably doing a great job. If you want them to just randomly respond to things without any intentionality, then parent that way, and you will probably raise children who are like that. But if you say, we want them to have something in mind, then you ask yourself, okay, then how do we intentionally do that? And by the way, here's the really hardship for those of us with more than one child is, each child you're going to have to do this a little bit differently. Because they're going to naturally be bent towards some traits that are awesome, and you can encourage that and uplift that. But understand, then there's going to be... So this is the case across the board. I have a child, and Mark is my eldest. He's 19. And Mark is as self-motivated a human being as I've ever known. He is way more self-motivated than his father, for example. Way more so. I mean, I have never seen a kid so internally disciplined in their own minds. I mean, homeschooling this kid was a breeze. It was easy. And you told him what he needed to get done, and he would figure out how to manage his time and coordinate everything he was supposed to get done. And then he would get, if he didn't know how to do something, he would look it up and figure out how to do it. And I mean, it was like magic. Educating Mark was magical. You would say, hey, dude, I mean, what do you, when you're dealing with a kid who's 12 and 13 years old going, hey, dad, I don't remember the first time he wanted to meet with you, Travis, but he was like, he said, hey, I want to improve some certain things about myself. And so what do you think about me trying to meet with Travis Bearden and see if he can help me with some of these things? Well, what teenager does that, right? And by the way, one of them was the ability to buy and wear a suit correctly. What teenager does that, right? And so that is his gifting. So for Mark, we had to teach him risk taking. Because he's naturally not a risk taker. That's not him. If it looks hard, well, we'll just choose something else, right? And his sister was very different when it came to risk taking. Ellie was a risk taker from day one. Mark, very wise, would come into the edge of something and go like, by the way, those of you who are Pine Cove, I'm specifically thinking about the walkway down to the Woods dining hall that has that ridge with all the stacked logs. Mark would walk up to it and go like, I don't think this is safe. And then would walk around. And Ellie would run and jump with all she had off of it, hit and fall and bite it, and get back up and do it again until she could do it without falling. And so, guess what? We don't have to teach risk-taking to Ellie. She gets that naturally. But we do have to teach wisdom at a more intentional level with Ellie, right? How to make good friends, because she's always choosing the least lovable person present and the person who doesn't love themselves the most. That's the good way to think of it. Whoever doesn't love themselves the most, that's who Ellie is going to become friends with, which is awesome until she gets old enough to date, and then you kind of panic, like, we don't do dating that way, just so you'll know. Like, we don't pursue the guys who love themselves the least. Like, that's a humble's fine, dysfunctional. Anyway, so Holland's natural bent, Holland's a party guy, and so he doesn't like to work hard. I mean, it's 7 when I assigned Mark to lay sod. He and I laid sod for 3 straight hours. At age 7, he could work for 3 hours, no problem, just laying sod with me. I mean, you had 30 minutes of focused attention on something, and Holland wants to do something else. He's like, can we go do this now? I've been working so long. Can we? That's, every kid is different like that. Why? Right? So for Holland, part of intentional parenting with Holland is, some of you know about this, I had to create a project last summer that was going to take many, many, many hours of work and assign it to Holland and have him figure out how to do those hours of work. It didn't even matter to me whether it turned out well. That was not part of my goal. The goal was to give Holland hours of work to do and that he could see it done and he could see how it worked and then to pay him for it, to let him see the reward at the end of hard work. And so last night at my house, walking a friend to the project where we created an outdoor kind of living space with lights in the trees and everything, and hearing Holland give kind of a guided tour of it and describe how much work he had to do, it doesn't look so cool, and the lights in the trees, and then telling him, like, and I got paid like $110. And I mean, like, the entire thing, you're going, as a parent, going, yep, this is why we did this. He now has that in his head. I worked hard. I made it happen. I was rewarded. Because we reward hard work as one of the family rules in our home. Now, there's lots of them. That's not the most important one, but that's one of them, which Mark understood day one. Ellie gets pretty easily. Holland, not so much. He's having to learn that a much harder way. Every kid's a little bit different, but when you go, what do they need to be working with? Some friends of ours who are now members of the church, the Langemeyers, that I don't know if they still do this, but at one stage they would every year go through with each kid and say, what is the one character trait this year needs to be the emphasis for this child? Each child, this year it's this year it's this, this year it's this. I know some of you guys do that as well. That's intentional parenting, saying this is what we're moving, this is where we're seeing them, this is where we want them. These are the mindsets, the skill sets, the character traits that we want to see in them when they're adults. How much work do we need to do about each of those? So if you've not taken a few minutes, make sure in the next, but you know, this week or something, to sit down with your spouse, or if it's just you, to sit down and think about, what are the traits I want them to walk away with? If you can't do that, you cannot discipline correctly, because discipline is not just punishment. Punishment is reactive. I always take a second and comment on the natural tendency for humans is to punish with emotion. That the main consequence for most children, if you just watch parents parenting, that the main consequence for bad behavior is my emotion. Okay? So you've done wrong, now I'm mad. And by the way, wrong is defined as the things that make me mad today. This teaches children, which is actually, what's funny is I'd mean this when I say, when you made your list in your head, did any of you put manipulate people's emotions as one of your top 10 skills or mindsets you wanted your child to have? Most people don't. And I ask that seriously. There's huge money to be made in manipulating people's emotions. That may be some of the skill you do want your child to have, but most people don't. But the way we parent is, if you make me mad, you face consequences. Therefore, children aren't stupid. They learn to manipulate our emotions because that's the skill set that we're rewarding them for having or punishing them for failing at. And so you want to ask yourself, because that is fundamentally the main consequence most children face for bad behavior or for whatever is mom or dad's wrath or sadness or heartbreak or whatever. Now, of course, you're going to be angry when your children do things that inspire anger. You just don't want the anger to be the punishment. You want there to be a punishment. You want there to be a discipline process. We'll talk more about that. So with that in mind, here's another way of understanding what I believe is really the goal of parenting. This is the picture that we use all the time as the coins. So if you've ever seen us, any of us from Aletheia talk about parenting, we talk about these coins. We use these coins as a picture. The coins, the concept of the coins, and this is why it's called freedom-based parenting. Most parenting and most parenting training is about how to make your children be more responsible, which I think is a mistake in parenting. I'm not saying it's wrong to help your children be more responsible. I'm saying if that's your goal for parenting, then you're going to get some stuff backwards. Stop and ask yourself, is that the fundamental of the kingdom of heaven? Is the fundamental of the kingdom of heaven about Jesus making us more responsible? That is a consequence. It's one of the good things, but that's not the fundamental. God isn't coming to us going like, well, let me know when you're responsible. Tell you what, I will give good things to you when you get your stuff together. That's how most of us try to parent, is we say, when you prove it, then I give. So we put the child in the position to be the one fighting for their own freedom. And I think that's a mistake. I think we need to be the agents of freedom in our children's life. The coins represent freedom on one side and responsibility on the other. What children and often parents don't understand is they are the same coin. You can't get one without the other. You can't be successful with one without the other. And here's what most people really have a hard time with, especially in the church. Parenting is fundamentally about getting these out of your hands and into their hands. That's what you're working for. That's the goal you have, is I've got to get all of these coins, freedom and responsibility, by the time they leave me, I have to have them all out of my hands into their hands. So practically, so we talk about the theology of it, but practically, that's parenting. It's taking a child who owns no freedom and no responsibility. They're not responsibility for their own poop. You have no responsibility if you're not responsible for pooping. We get them that way. They have none. They have no freedom. They're tiny little things rolled up in a bassinet or in a cage. What do we call those? Cribs. And they have no freedom and they have no responsibility. Why? Why don't they have freedom or responsibility? Because they can't survive either at that age. Right? That's the good measuring stick. So that as we step in and we are agents of freedom to our children, and we know that freedom and responsibility are the same, are conceptually the same thing. This is also a problem we're having in America right now at the government level, at the political level, is our freedom and responsibility are the same thing. And we have, again, bad parenting on both sides of the aisle at this point. But to say, how do you give these away? Your job is to figure out what can they survive and then get them out of your hands. Because what you don't want to have happen is to have a whole lot of coins left when they leave. So now that I've actually gotten to do this, since the last time I taught this, I had never done that. Now I have. So I drove away from DBU feeling in my gut like I broke up with my girlfriend. That's the only feeling that even came close. This feeling of sinking horror of leaving my son someplace else other than my home, which is not where he belongs. And that's with all of it being good. I mean, like, I can't imagine for parents who have to deal with this in a bad way. I mean, he was at a good school with good scholarships, with great professors, in a safe place, in a discipleship program. You can't ask for a better option for parents. And I still felt like someone had kicked me in the gut as I drove away. But thankfully, I didn't have to give Mark a single new freedom or responsibility that day. They were all in his hands. And most of them had been for a long time. That's the goal, is to make sure that we're not, and Christian families, that we're not saying, hey, as you head off to college, hey, as you head off to school, hey, as you head off to work or whatever, here's the last 40% of freedom and responsibility. Responsibility, by the way, another word for responsibility is choices over consequences. You get to choose your own consequences, or at least you get to choose natural consequences as one of your options. That's what I mean by responsibility. It's choices over consequences. So here's the situation. Deal with it. It's one of those hilarious, again, every kid is a little bit different, but dealing with those situations of how do I get these into your hands? So how do you do it? Well, I believe the correct answer is you are fighting for freedom for them. You are looking for them to expand their boundaries. You're looking for them to take these things off of your hand. You are the one going, I think you can do this. I think you can handle this. I think this is an option for you. And anytime you can initiate that conversation, it's incredibly powerful. So I grew up in an era and in a place outside of Nacogdoches in the woods where boundaries were very clear. And I mean, someone was talking about this the other day. I don't remember who it was. And I was laughing because they were kind of poking fun at the mindset of, you know, the kind of the deep woods mindset of boundaries. But so, like, I remember this summer, because both my parents worked and I stayed home all summer. And I don't remember how young I was when that started, but I was young when that started. And knowing, hey, you're the creek. About 100 feet behind our house was a creek. Creek's your boundary. With I'm not here, you don't cross the creek. And one whole summer, that was the boundary. The next summer, there was a trail. It was called Doug's Trail because there was a kid who had graduated years ago named Doug at the other end of the trail. And it was called Doug's. It was just, I never met Doug. It was Doug's Trail, though. Been passed down through the neighborhood, Doug's Trail. So the Doug's Trail, that was a line. The next year, there's a barbed wire fence on the other side of Doug's Trail that cuts off where people's property from the thousands of acres of woodlands behind our house was. That was a line. Anybody from Nacogdoches? Then it was Lenana Creek, about another mile, straight back through the woods. Then it was the railroad tracks in Appleby, now about 2.5 miles, straight in the woods into my house. Every year, my boundaries expanded a little bit. Now, I had to ask, Dad, what? How far can I go? I had to sometimes fight for that. Come on, Dad, I think it's okay to... If my parents had been better at freedom-based parenting, my father would have sat down with me before the summer every year, and my mom would have said, this year, we've talked about it, and we've decided we think you're ready for Doug's Trail. We think you're ready for Doug's Trail to be the new line. And I might have been like, wow, that's a couple hundred yards into the woods. I mean, that's kind of scary. Yeah, but we think you're ready. That's the role you want to find yourself in. Giving them the opportunity. Can I survive it? Apparently they think I can. Now, if I prove I'm not safe with that, or if I prove that I can't handle it, then you just take that coin back and you wait. And you come back another day and say, okay, apparently you weren't able to handle that. That's what grounding is supposed to be. Grounding is saying, no, okay, we're pulling the leash back in. This week, I know it's a bummer. This week, you're back to the creek as your boundary. You don't get to go to Doug's Trail. You do good this week, we'll go back to Doug's Trail. And that's the idea. But you're pursuing that, not making them fight for it. That's freedom-based parenting, is you're saying, how do I get this in their hands? How do I say, hey, you get the opportunity to do this. Hey, you get the opportunity to do this. I want you to, you're introducing them to things that you're saying, I think it's the right time. You're not waiting for them to ask you about sex. You're starting the conversation with them about sex. You're not waiting for them to talk to you about these things. You're initiating these conversations. You're initiating these things, bringing them in whenever you can, as safely as you can. And the line for me is, can they survive it? You don't always 100% on this. And there comes a point when, by the way, you have to give up on that. At 16, when they don't have a driver's license, there's a chance they won't survive it. At some point, it has to be, do I think they're likely to survive it, becomes part of it. But when you're the one saying, you know what, I think we need to send you away for camp this weekend. We need to send you away for camp this, and you know your children, for some children, that's really young. For some children, that's not till much later. You have to know your children well enough to know what pushes them, but doesn't traumatize them, doesn't damage them, doesn't harm them. And you have to just figure that out the best you can. In a perfect world, it's a conversation between a husband and a wife, because typically speaking, not universally, but typically speaking, husbands are comfortable with further freedoms and with demanding more responsibilities. And wives are typically more satisfied drawing those lines back in a little bit. And usually somewhere in between is probably the best answer. Now, this isn't universal, but that's a typical, that Women typically, moms typically feel safe knowing their children are in the castle walls, and dads typically feel safe knowing their child can survive outside the castle walls. And both are needed. Children need to be inside the castle walls sometimes in order to learn and grow and be safe, because safety creates development and growth, and they need to know how to survive outside. Again, that's not a universal by any means. It's just kind of a generality. The example that I use over and over again when I teach on this is I'm going to the zoo. So some of you heard me use this exact example. If you're going to the zoo in Tyler, Texas in November, and your 10-year-old boy says, I don't want to wear a coat, because for some reason, 10-year-old boys don't like wearing coats. I felt the same way. I don't know why. If I knew why, there's two or three things from childhood that I wish I'd taken notes. I'd be like, what's my reasoning behind this? No. Because coats are obviously stupid. I have no idea. I don't know. That makes no sense to me. I don't want to wear a coat. Okay. Can your child survive not wearing a coat at age 10 in November in Tyler? Probably so, right? I mean, unless you know for sure it's a really, really bad weekend, they're probably going to be fine. Are they going to be cold? Yes, they are. So discomfort isn't the line. Do not protect your children from discomfort. You're not offering them freedom or responsibility to always be protecting them from discomfort. You want to protect them from what they can survive, from what they can't survive. And so can they survive that? Yes. Now, you may need to draw boundaries. Boundaries are one of the great gifts that God gave parents. You may need to say, listen, we're not going to complain. You're not going to borrow somebody else's coat. And we're not coming home early. But you don't have to wear a coat. And then you have to enforce those three boundaries. And they go and they're cold. When they start to whine, you go, no. We talked about this in advance. We're not going to whine. And if you do, there'll be a consequence for it. It's a boundary, right? And now listen, if they're three and they say, I don't want to wear a coat, you might go, you know what? Put on a coat. You're too young to make that decision. I'm not sure you can survive that. I'm not sure because if for nothing, I may kill you, right? With all the whining and grumping that you're going to do if you don't, right? So it's figuring out what can they handle and what can they not handle? What can they survive and what can they not survive? You don't want to do the world mindset, which is to say, oh, well, you know, what is healthy for them? And by the way, I'm not using survival literally only in the physical heart still beating sense. It's psychologically, is it going to traumatize them? Is it going to harm them? Is part of the conversation. Is this going to be harmful to them? Is this going to hurt that may or may not be necessary? That's part of freedom and responsibility, is experiencing discomfort and sometimes pain. Is it going to harm them is a different question. Is this going to do long-term damage to them is a different question. If it is, then you're going to say, you know what, we're going to hold back on that. And you may have to fight about what you think is going to harm your child and what isn't going to harm your child. I'm not telling you what those are. That is family by family and child by child, for sure. Now, if you're going to the zoo in Anchorage, Alaska in November, and your 10-year-old son says, I don't want to wear a coat, you say, you put on a coat. Because you literally may lose body parts if you don't wear a coat in Anchorage in November. So whether liking wearing the coat or not, I'm not giving you that freedom. It's the same reason we let a 3-year-old play in traffic and go, well, I guess you'll learn your lesson when you're, sure, go out in the road. I guess you'll learn. That's control over natural consequences, and we don't give that to little children and things that they can't handle, the things they can't survive. That's why they need parents, is to tell them, no, you're four. I know you think that would be a fun movie that all your friends are going to go see. You're not going to go see it because I don't want to pay for the therapy of the consequences of you seeing that. You all go there. You go to a movie, and there's kids there that you're like, well, who thought to bring this kid to this? I've always said I'm going to hand out business cards, right? Carry business cards with me to the... Jennifer would appreciate that. Just walk around and be like, hey, when they have nightmares, call this number. Call this number. Actually, I have once or twice handed a business card. Questions or comments at this point? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is that unequivocal? I guess I'm thinking about particular areas where my kids would love to have the coin that I'm not willing to give them. I mean, should I try to be out in front of them and pressing that on them?
Okay.
Technology and devices and things like that. Like, he would love to have pushing an envelope out in front of where he is, or are there some situations where I shouldn't be pushing that?
Great question. When I say we should be pushing that, I don't mean the child is not a measure of what freedoms and responsibilities we give. They are going to demand certain things that it's not time for them to have. They're going to want certain things it's not time for them to have. But what I mean in general is, what we don't want to do is say, when you prove yourself worthy of a whatever, then you get one. It's going to be, when I think you're ready, I'm going to give you. We will go there. I'm not withholding a good thing from you. It's just not time yet. So when I think it's time, believe me, I will be giving this to you. I will be pushing these things on you and teaching you how to use them and how to engage with them. One of the big questions, and we don't have time to get into this, when we talk a little bit next week about adolescence, is the issue of the internet being so potentially harmful, has such harmful potential because of what is on the internet, that you have to be, that's an area of care that has a totally other conversation in saying, I want you to have freedoms, and yet the problem is there's such an unrestricted aspect to what's there that we have to restrict it until we think it's safe for you. That's not about something you earn. That's not about something you fight for. In fact, fighting for it usually is a counterexample that you're ready for it. But is, we will be the one who brings this to you when it's time. And part of it is what you don't want to get caught in, and this is what I would tell you, Chad, probably mainly is, you need to be out ahead in different places. There may be things that they never considered doing on their own, or knowing how to do, or pushing the boundaries. They're emphasizing or focused or even obsessed with one specific thing. I want to play this game. I want to see this movie. I want to have this screen. And us saying, no, but this. You know what? I have been thinking recently that it's probably time for us to do this. It's time for us to go experience this together. So I want to get this, you know, first person shooter game at this age. I'm obsessing over it. You go, no, I don't think it's time for that yet, but I do think it's time for you to go experience what it's like to shoot a real gun. Like, there's a freedom that you may go like, whoa. The kid may go like, wait, what? Really? Like, you know what? I think maybe it's time for that. This is for here, for whatever reason, is not something I'm ready for you to have yet. And so it's an ongoing conversation. It's not easy. The fact that a child is asking for something doesn't mean you've fallen behind, though. Don't equate those. What you want to be doing, though, is not waiting around in general. You want to be asking that question. If in a perfect world, and none of us are perfect parents, in a perfect world, they would come to you and say, Dad, I want an iPad. And you would go, that's 11. And you're only 9. And they're like, wait, what? Like, no, I've already thought about this. We've already talked about it. We know you. We've discussed it. And what we've decided is, at 11, we're planning on taking care of that. Don't ask until then. And at 11, we'll figure out a way to get it to you. If right now we think that's going to be right. If it turns out to be right, we'll do that. That's really cool when you can have that regard, that your children know, I'm out in front of this in that I'm thinking about it. I'm strategizing about it. I've got thought about rules about it. And the earlier, by the way, one of the funny things about parenting is, and some of you have caught on to this, the earlier you start putting boundaries in place, the more normalizing that is for a child. And they don't know, that that's strange. My poor kids, when they go to someone's house and they have a screen of any kind in their room, I mean, my kids don't know what to do with that. They're like, Dad, it's like the biggest, the horrible secret like that they have. Like, you know, they have animals chained up in their basement and they have a TV in their room. Like, what? And so it's like, yeah, I know. They must be Satanists. We don't do screens in rooms. I think that's a very good boundary, by the way, a very healthy boundary. I think the research is backing that. But yes.
Talk a little bit. You talk about giving your kid a freedom because you think they're ready for that.
Yep.
Or
I really want you to be ready for this. I think that's the kid in the movie scenario, right? Is the kid, the 4-year-old in the Harry Potter movie, is like, well, I wanted to see Harry Potter. And I didn't want to pay for a babysitter, so I just took you with, right? Yeah, be wary of the fact that this is all about disciplining the child, meaning moving them from where they are to where you want them to be. And so that means this is about their best interest, not because, by the way, reactive parenting in the moment is easier than intentional parenting, than discipline, freedom-based parenting. It's harder work. You've got to be thinking. You've got to be out in front of the child. You've got to be considering these things. You've got to be engaging in these conversations. Now, long-term, that's not the case at all. Long-term, intentional, freedom-based parenting, which involves discipline, not just punishment, is long-term way easier. Ask any parent of a teenager who's done it. Now, or ask any parent of a teenager who hasn't done it. And that's the nightmare of having a teenager who does not know what's normative. They don't know about these type of things. The amount of therapy that I've had to do over the years with families who failed to train up a child, and now they're dealing with an adolescent who doesn't understand the way the world works, and who, I mean, even still to this day, I try to imagine the first time I had a parent say, the discipline for their child, because this is the gift of cell phones is it's truly a gift for parents, because it's like removing an appendage when you take it from a teenager. It's awesome. I used to be grounded for 2 weeks to receive the type of pain they receive in 1 hour. Like, hand over the phone for an hour. And they fall apart in the same way I would have for 2 weeks of grounding. I mean, the amount of social interchange that happens in that hour is probably pretty close to what I would have experienced in 2 weeks. And so it's a huge amount of crisis. And you go like, nope, 1 hour. Come back and get it in an hour. It's amazing. Well, the first time I had a parent say, well, what if they tell me no? I'm like, okay, now that's interesting that's a question that you're wrestling through, is what if they tell me no? Like, the amount of powerlessness that comes from that terminology, from immediate. Now, I do understand that with single moms with adolescent boys, because adolescent boys are narcissistic and can be abusive. And so you tell him no, and he may get physically, if he's out of control, he could be physically out of control. But beyond that, even under those conditions, there are ways to handle it. But we have to strategize through. But the level of powerlessness that many parents express, but I think part of it's because they've been reacting the whole time. And reacting is powerless. And reacting ends up being something that you don't intend for it to be, that you don't want it to be. Instead of saying, here's the plan. Here's how we're going to get from here to here. And again, you're still going to end up reacting in different situations. They will surprise you no matter what you plan for. But to say, here's how we're going to handle this and move forward with this, it requires a lot of intentionality. It's discipline, not just punishment. We've talked about, punishment. Punishment is the reactive response, reactive to how you're making me feel. It's what we do sometimes with our spouses too. You're creating a bad feeling in me, and now I'm going to create a bad feeling in you so that you know better than to create a bad feeling in me. So you're embarrassing me in the store, so I'm going to humiliate you in front of your friends so that you won't embarrass me in the store. This is bad parenting. It's reactive-based, emotion-based parenting. That's not what parenting is supposed to be like. You have to be different than that. And here's some of the great... So vision is one of the great... The concept of greatness versus success, intentionality, ministry, the development of those skill sets and mindsets, that's a huge part. That's one of the great tools of freedom-based parenting, is the vision of it. The discipline is... All these fall under heading of discipline. Punishment is one of them. Punishment is a tool that's used to discipline children. It's a negative reaction to something that they do. But here's how... So just like in a performance evaluation, what's the number? Those of you here in business world at all, what's the main rule of a performance evaluation? Okay, that's good. That's not the main rule. Sandwiching good and bad is a great guideline, but that's not... What is it? Never give a perfect score. Oh, no, you can give perfect scores. That is a rule that people use. I don't understand that. You always got to say something bad. Like, what if there is anything bad? Am I supposed to invent something? Nothing should surprise them. That's the rule. The rule is nothing should be a surprise in a performance evaluation. If you've ever been surprised in a performance evaluation, the boss wasn't doing their job. That means they weren't communicating the way they need to communicate. Nothing should ever be a surprise. Think of punishment that way. Your child should never be surprised by your punishment. Like, yep, knew that was coming, is what you want. I mean, you want a, it's always funny to me, we rarely, and this is controversial, I know, and that's fine, we rarely use any type of corporal punishment, but there are times when they're at a certain age or in a certain situation where it seems like that's the best, there's a best immediate way to draw immediate attention to something. Again, I know that there's plenty of people who disagree, and that's fine. But it is intriguing to see whether that whatever the consequence is, to see a child know before it happens what's about to happen. That indicates they understand the consequences. That's a healthier way, no matter what it is. Whether you have a child who starts to put themselves in a timeout before even being asked, or whether they start going to their room, or if they're like me, if they reach back like this when I was a kid, when mom walked over to talk to me and I reached back like that, like at least the idea is you know what's coming. There's again, I know there's disagreement on some of that kind of stuff. But that's punishment. Punishment is a negative consequence for misbehavior, for crossing a boundary, for whatever, and it comes with that mindset. Now, that's one. Second, we've talked about vision, we talked about punishment. Here's another one: listening. This is the main skill that parents lack in parenting, is taking time to listen to what's going on with the child and to ask them to understand what's going on. If you've ever done foster training or those type of things, one of the first ones, the first thing you do is you engage with the child where they are and you find out what's going on with them. The SAMA training. That's right. So it's very helpful, isn't it? When you figure out what's going on with you, why do you think that's going on? What do you think we can do differently? Those type of questions that engage the child in that moment, and you're hearing what they say. This is an important skill. I'm going to move on because we're going to talk about it a lot next week with adolescents. It is definitely the biggest failing of parents of adolescents. We talk instead of listen. Blessings. You've noticed probably that it's a natural temptation, if you're not careful, especially if you have numerous kids, that all you're doing all day is correcting. And 80% of what you say is negative. That is something you want to get out ahead of by intentionally saying positives, by intentionally speaking positives. The child may not inspire the positives in you as quickly. So you need to have times to communicate the positives. Again, the old management by walking around, that you would say, I catch my children doing what's right. So that's a reward system can be a part of that. That's great. A reward system can be a big part of that. Catching them doing what's right and rewarding that. However you do that, this is the type of thing we reward and you do. Now, if you're like most families, you create a reward system or even a punishment system and it comes in and you do well with it for a little while and then you kind of slowly you stop doing it and life goes on. And that's okay. That's part of the ups and downs of life. Then you jump back in and keep doing it. And then when you mess up and you forget or whatever, you jump back in and keep doing it. Don't feel like some big failure because you have 19 different discipline charts that you've used over their short little lives. That's okay. You keep engaging with that. As much as it's predictable, that's better. But the blessing, so that you're speaking into them. We have this modeled by God the Father with God the Son, as well as with us. He loved us before we loved him. But that with God the Father speaking over his Son, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. This is before Jesus has performed anything. This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. It's a great discipline to daily or close to daily, or at least strive to daily, speak some version of that over your kids. That you're my son, you're my daughter, I'm proud of you, I'm pleased that you're my child. In the mixture of all the positives and negatives that come in the normal daily life, you did bad at this, you did good at this, this was awesome, this was terrible, I'm so proud of this, I thought this was a nightmare, all that kind of stuff, that you make sure that there's some expression, a foundational expression of this in some ways. Putting this on in writing, putting it on their walls, putting it in art, I don't know, anything that reminds kids of this foundation, that this is a fundamental. And there's a great old book called The Blessing by Smalley and Trent. A lot of older books like that get out of date. This is such a fundamentals book that I don't know that it'll ever go out of date. Like the basic ways of giving a kid a blessing, of speaking a positive future over them. Physical touch. I had somebody ask me today at Womenary, come up to me and say, like, okay, I just heard someone say that after about age 9 or 10, that it's important that you not be too affectionate with your children because that will turn them, like, into sissies or weak. And I was like, yeah, that's just a lie from hell. Like, oh, my gosh, what the heck? Where would anyone have even... I was like, please tell me that wasn't, like, a professional in some kind of... Like, what? No, that's not how that works at all. Like, children don't somehow outgrow... Did you outgrow affection? I haven't. Like, what a weird concept. I was really weirded out by, please tell me that's not real. Like, you're just making that up to ask me. You're like, I got to ask Chris a question because he's standing there. I'm going to make something up. Please tell me. That was not an actual thing that happened. No, children need us to be affectionate. The way we're affectionate may change as they get older. And that's because you don't want to be creepy. You just want to be affectionate. And that's sometimes that's, there's no doubt that sometimes that's tough. And for dads, it's hard to know with daughters sometimes. But what you don't want to do is do this weird like thing that sometimes happens, especially between dads and daughters, where dads like at some point become creeped out by how much the daughter looks like the mom when he fell in love with the mom. And then they're like, oh, I better not get anywhere near her because now she's like just another. No, it's still your daughter. You just have to kind of embrace and understand what's okay and what's not okay. And you have to, sometimes you have just to ask with a teenage girl if that's allowed. Is this type of hug okay or not? Is it a little weird or none? And again, if you have a good relationship with your teenage daughter, they don't mind having that conversation with you in my experience. But there's something to that. It doesn't, but no, you don't stop being affectionate with a child. And every family is a little bit different for what kind of affection, how much affection is appropriate or not. That's fine. But yes, that is one of the blessings that they need. I know I'm going fast. Sorry. We talked about setting boundaries and communicating consequences. This is one of the quick ones. It's such a powerful thing to do. And the sooner you do it in an engagement, the better for the child. Because they need to be able to predict what's coming next. They understand that their job is to figure out what it means to be them in the world. Where do you end and they begin? This is part of what they have to learn. At 2 and 3, when they're defying you, when they're calling you names, when they're telling you that they hate you, and they may do it again at 13 and 14, this is part of the problem. That doesn't mean it's okay. It's just respectful. It needs a consequence. But understand, this is the lesson I'm going to say is toughness. And I don't mean theirs. I mean yours. Understand, it's nothing personal. This is their job. They're supposed to be doing that. They're supposed to be figuring out where do I end and you begin. What do boundaries mean? That when you say there's a boundary here, some of them need to test that boundary a lot of times. Some do quickly. Some are super adaptable. If you've got multiple kids, you probably have at least one super adaptable. Like, there's the rule. Got it. That's easy. They fool you into thinking you're a good parent. Those kids do, right? Other kids, you're like, there's the boundary. They're like, this one? Like, they're 45 minutes later, they're still kicking. This one? Did you mean it? I don't think you meant it. I don't think this is a real boundary. That's a fake laugh. That's not a real laugh. You don't really mean this as a boundary, do you? Do you really mean this as a boundary? And at the end of the day, go, okay, I guess you meant it as a boundary. And then wake up the next day and go, like, I don't think that boundary's there anymore. I don't think. And about there's not a right or wrong. Adaptable kids move more easily through life. Yay for them, right? But it's not necessary to be an adaptable kid to be successful in life. That's part of it. Go, they need to test that. Over and over again, sometimes, and it's important that you're able to do that. If you've drawn too many boundaries and you're having to monitor everything, if you've child-proofed your life to the degree that every little thing is a boundary, yeah, don't do that. That'll exhaust you, and then you will end up not really doing any of them. With each of our kids, we would usually, when they were real little, we would pick one. And sometimes we would intentionally, like, this tells you, I mean, Mark's 19, so it was the VCR. Right? That was back when there were VCRs. But it was the VCR, was one of Mark's. We intentionally didn't put it up out of reach because we knew he'd want to play with it. We knew he'd want it, but he wasn't allowed to. And so that was one of his. Like we picked fights intentionally that we knew we could win, and then we would just discipline, like, no, we don't do that. No, we don't do that. No, we don't do that until he would learn that pattern, and then we could try something else, and you could expand on that. That's that works especially when they're real little. But you create a boundary. You say, this is the line. We don't do this. We don't do this with teenagers. We're not online outside of the main room. So if you're going to get online, you have to ask permission to be online in your room. You can be online out here. If we catch you in your room and you're online and you can get permission, we take it away till tomorrow. No biggie, no shame. Can't do that. You know we can't do that. Oh, bummer, busted. We take it. When you set that standard, this is what a boundary works. I draw a boundary, and you either adapt to it, or you face a consequence. But here's what's not going to happen. The boundary's not going to move because you demanded it. I may decide to move it. It's my boundary. At some point, I will decide to move it, but not right now. And you demanding that I move it guarantees I cannot move it right now. You cannot move it when the child thinks you're moving it because of something they did to make you move it. Now, they can earn moving it under certain circumstances. That's a little bit different. But if it's just, I threw a big enough fit. This is the nightmare version of parenting. This is one of the ones I've had to teach a lot of moms, this one, in the counseling office. Because it happens in the counseling office sometimes. That they're sitting there with their three-year-old, and the three-year-old said, they walk over to something on the bookshelf, and they're like, I want to touch this. And the mom's like, don't touch that, don't touch that, don't touch that, don't touch that. Don't. And the child's like, I want to touch it, 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 I want to touch it. Mama, 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 right? At some point, mom finally goes like, fine, you can touch it. I'm like, whoa. Just so you'll know, he just asked you 400 times to touch that. And you said no, 399. And you finally gave in on 400. He's not stupid. What did he just learn? You better ask at least 400 times whenever she says no. At least 400. Because you never know, 400 could be the one where suddenly you get a yes. Is that what you want to train your children to do? They're smarter than dogs, and dogs know to do this. If you have dogs, they know to do this. And dogs learn rather quickly. Little children are more like puppies than sometimes we're like comfortable with. But they're just kind of a cause and effect relationship at times. There's a little bit of that in them. There's an instinct response. But that's part of what you're dealing with that is you want to make it. This is a boundary. You don't do that. So, questions, comments. So instead you want to say, one second. Instead you want to say, you asked if you can have candy in the checkout line. The answer was no. And the answer is no. If you ask again, there will be a consequence. If you don't ask again, there may be a reward, or there will be this certain reward. It won't be this, but it may be something else. And so you just set that boundary up for them. Don't wait for them to ask 3,000 times. After the first time or the second time, you go, listen, we're not doing that. If you ask again, there's going to be this consequence. The sooner in the process that you engage in that boundary, the better for you and the child. Because they need to know what they need to fight against or not fight against. Until they know, they just flail around. So it's important to know. They're going to ask that. Yes, ma'am. You have to evaluate. So what do you do with a boundary that seems to not be, they're not getting the boundary? They're not getting it. So one is they may, that you may just have to keep doing it until they get it. But you do have to evaluate, okay, did I draw a boundary in the wrong place? Now, with a child's old enough, it's always cool to get, by the way, children really respect this. You will remember, if your parents ever did this, when they came back to you and said, yeah, we thought this. Turns out, we're probably being too strict. It really should be here. Children will go like, oh, weakness. They don't see you acknowledging your own imperfection typically as weakness. They see it as strength. They love that. Children love that. If you've never apologized to your child, then you're missing a huge opportunity to really bless them when you go, oh, yeah, I blew that. Wow, that was not mommy or daddy at their best. So I own that. I blew it. And that's my bad. And if I gave you a consequence in anger, let me reevaluate it. You may still need a consequence, but I may have overdone it, or I may have drawn it too tight, or it may have been a perfectly appropriate boundary 2 years ago, and 2 years later, the reason they're still kicking against it is because now it's not an appropriate boundary still. It's not an appropriate boundary anymore, and you may go, I need to now move this boundary, and we need to figure out another way to teach. Remember, the boundary, asking for something at the checkout line isn't the point. Teaching respect, obedience, those are the point. And so if you go, this is not teaching them the point, is there another way we can teach them this same lesson taught in a different way? That's the mindset. Is there a way I can move this along, get this coin moving along. I'm going to mention real quickly the lethality of expectations. This is one of those places, you know, I'm not a fan of expectations. This is one of those places where it's really dangerous, is when we compare parenting to our parents, or we compare our responses to our parents' responses, or to our responses to our parents versus our children's responses to us. Parenting is not another word for hazing. So just because your parents did something stupid or poorly or meanly or arrogantly or cruelly, you're allowed to move away from that. I've been stunned. It's been one of those funny things, like to be stunned sometimes when a dad who's really on edge about something in the counseling office will say, "I would never have spoken to my dad that way." And they've got this very firm steel, like, I feel like a man saying this. "I would never have spoken to my dad the way my son speaks to me." And when I say, well, that may be because you're a way better dad than your dad. It may be because your children don't fear you the way you feared your dad. Maybe they just respect you, and they know that you're a patient person, and so they can test boundaries with you and still be safe. Now, they may get a consequence, but they're safe. Maybe because you're going, well, if I'd said that, I'd have received the hard end of a belt buckle. Mm-hmm. And you're not stupid. You learned not to even go near that line. But the problem is, here you are as an adult man, and you still don't feel safe. So it may be that you're doing a better job parenting your children, which is why your children feel a little more gutsy with you than you did with your dad. Because they know they may get in trouble, but they know they're not going to be harmed. That's a better place for children. And that's one of those shockers, like when a dad hears that and goes, I don't know what to do with that. Like, okay, let me reevaluate all of this. Because they thought they're living by the expectation of dad. Dad's somewhere up in heaven judging how bad a dad I am because my teenager just said something disrespectful to me and I never would have said it to my dad. Yeah, well, maybe you need to have a bigger perspective. The last one is we're running out of time here. We'll pick this up next time, and because this definitely falls under adolescence, is toughness. One of the great skills is toughness. I'll give more skills next week under adolescence, and Ashley Coleman hopefully will be here to team teach the adolescent stuff with me. And by toughness, I mean our toughness, not their toughness. Interestingly, children tend to actually learn toughness from not having to be tough at home. That actually is what creates toughness, is not having to be. That doesn't mean not push, not uncomfortable. That's all good. If that's what you mean by tough, that's fine. But if meaning I have to protect myself, I have the ability to protect myself, children who don't have to protect themselves at home are more likely to be able to protect themselves outside of the home, not the other way around. Kids who have to protect themselves at home, they're not bully-proof. They are bullies or they're being bullied. And those are the ones that predators look for, the kids who aren't safe at home. So don't feel like making them unsafe at home is a good thing. That's not what we're talking about. But when I say toughness, I mean the toughness of us to not take personally our children acting like children. We shouldn't consequence our children acting like children. Children who spill something at the table. I mean, if you can indicate to them, okay, I gave you a specific instruction to move that drink away from the edge of the table and you decided not to do it and you spilled it, okay, that may be disobedience. But a kid spilling something is a kid being a kid. A kid blowing bubbles in their milk, okay, you can tell them, hey, don't do that, or you'll face a consequence. You need to draw that. Understand, they don't know those boundaries automatically. They're children. They don't know propriety and things like that normally. So be patient with them being childish. We actually have a joke in our home when we had babies. One of the things that we would kind of laugh at ourselves with in order to deal with our own emotions when a baby was acting really badly is one of us would say, like, oh my gosh, don't you just wish they would stop acting like such a baby? Oh, wait, they're a baby. So that's right. The reason they're acting like such a big baby is because they're a big baby. That's actually what they are. So that's okay. It's nothing personal about us. Make sense? Okay, we'll pick up with parenting adolescents next week. I'm sorry I've run us totally out of time. If you have a question, don't hesitate to email me and ask, or bring it next week, and maybe at the beginning we can do a little Q&A. So let me pray over us as we send us out. We need help also resetting the room. If you've got kids, go get them. If you don't have to go get them, or you've got some margin or something like that, stay and help us reset the room, please. Father, we're so grateful for the goodness of who you are, and what an amazing thing that we get to call you Father. Billions of people on the planet do not, or believe they cannot, call you Father. And the fact that we get to do that is such a huge blessing, especially for me as a dad, knowing that where I fail and when I fail, that there are other men who you've placed in my children's life to model for them you. And that in the end, the person who's going to model you to them is truly you. Then my children someday can understand that they probably shouldn't even call anybody on earth Father, because they have a Father, and that is you in heaven. And you love them in ways I never will and never could. And you have served and sacrificed for them in ways I will never understand, probably. That I have the confidence in you. And that you pour out your grace on me as I attempt to live out what it is to live a parenting life filled with grace and freedom and the kind of love that you give us. And that your grace covers us in the midst of that. God, I pray that you would help us to live not with a sense of utter failure constantly, but of the knowledge that your grace is sufficient as we reach out and attempt to love these kids, and that you've called us to do it, and that you'll empower us if we'll listen. If we'll plug into your Spirit, the true dynamo, the source of power, we can do it through his power. I thank you, Father, for that example and that model, and for these awesome kids and for these awesome parents. Thank you for giving us so many in this church. In your Son's name, amen. Thanks, everybody.